Welcome to Piano Fortissimo, the podcast where the world of classical music meets personal stories and professional insights. I'm your host, Alexandra Silocha, concert pianist and bossa nova artist for over two decades. Join me as we explore the intricacies of music careers, the artistry behind pianos and other instruments, dive deep with special guests from all corners of the arts, and uncover the nuances of cultural and self-management. Whether you're an aspiring musician, a performer, or simply a music lover, this podcast offers something for everyone. Welcome back to episode number 5 of the Piano Fortissimo podcast. I'm Alexandra Silocha, and today we have something truly special to celebrate. On this very day, 74 years ago, September 16, 1950, one of the most moving and legendary performances in classical music took place, Dino Lipatti's final recital in Besançon. Despite his declining health, Lipatti delivered a performance that has since become the stuff of legend, leaving a profound mark on the world of piano. To help us honor this extraordinary anniversary, I am absolutely thrilled to be joined by none other than Mark Ainley. Mark Ainley is an internationally known expert in historical piano recordings. Starting in his teens, he began to collect and listen to recordings by the great pianists of the past. He became particularly interested in the Romanian pianist Dino Lipatti, whose handful of records have been universally admired by pianists of all generations. Over the course of several decades, Mark would discover long-lost recordings by the pianist and help them become publicly available. In 2016, he was invited by the Romanian Cultural Institute to Romania to present a series of seminars about his findings and Lipatti's artistry, and he contributed to a groundbreaking book about the pianist that they published. He has also focused on many other less-known pianists to help preserve their legacy, and his Facebook page, The Piano Files with Mark Ainley, and his Piano Files website have become premier online resources for insight about great pianists and their artistry. Mark has written booklet notes for many CD reissues of great pianists and published articles in several magazines, and he is now a regular contributor in International Piano Magazine with a column entitled Historical Perspectives. Dino Lipatti was a renowned Romanian pianist and composer, widely regarded as one of the greatest pianists of the 20th century. Despite his tragically short life, Lipatti left a lasting legacy due to his extraordinary sensitivity, impeccable technique, and deep musical insight. Born in Bucharest to a musically inclined family, Lipatti showed prodigious talent from a young age. He studied at the Bucharest Conservatory with Florica Muzicescu, and even after Lipatti left Romania to continue his studies in Paris under famous teachers like Alfred Cortot and Nadia Boulanger, he remained deeply appreciative of Muzicescu's influence. She continued to be a guiding presence in his life, and Lipatti would often consult her on artistic matters. Dino Lipatti was celebrated for his elegant and lyrical interpretations, particularly of composers like Chopin, Bach, Schumann, and Mozart. His playing was characterized by clarity, precision, and a profound emotional depth that resonated with audiences. Dino Lipatti's career was severely impacted by illness. He was diagnosed with Hodgkin disease, which limited his ability to perform and to record, and he died at the young age of 33. However, his recordings are still revered worldwide. Lipatti's last performance, given in September 1950, on this very day, on the 16th, was a legendary recital in Besançon, France, where, despite his frail health, he performed several works before being physically unable to continue. Dino Lipatti's recordings remain some of the most admired in the classical music world. His playing exemplifies purity of tone and musical integrity, making him a timeless figure in classical piano performance. His life and music continue to inspire pianists and music lovers, and his legacy is celebrated worldwide. Yehudi Menuhin was saying about Dino Lipati, "If it is true that music makes human relationships grow bigger and stronger, it is just as true that Dino Lipati was like a brother to me, George Enescu being our spiritual and musical godfather." Composer Mihail Jora was also writing, "One bleak autumn day, a small, frail child was being brought to me by his parents so that I would become his tutor. When I asked the father if the boy knew anything about music, he answered nothing at all. He doesn't even know the name of the notes, but he plays the piano by ear and he likes composing. I had seen such lot before in my room, so I didn't get my hopes too high. Rather bored, I asked the child to sit down at the piano. But this time, I realized my very experience had played me a trick. Little Lipati, as he would years to come be known, had an intuition and a gift for music which were completely unusual." Yvonne Lefebvre, his piano teacher at the Music Conservatory in Paris, was noting, "At his 17 years, Lipati has an exceptional technique, a structured mind, and a sense for music rarely encountered. He's the most diligent and the most modest of my students." Alfred Cortot was also writing to his impresario, Charles Kisken, on the occasion of Dino Lipati's recital in Montreux, "Dear friend, let me recommend to your untiring attention an exceptionally deserving young pianist, a second Horowitz, whose remarkable talent I was in the measure to observe during the International Piano Competition in Vienna, where he was awarded second prize, even if he should have by far won the first one. It is my duty to point out to you this great ace of tomorrow, and I can assure you that it is in your own interest that I do so, as we are talking here about nothing less than a revelation on the piano horizon. His name is Dino Lipati." And with this, I invite you to take a cup of coffee or a mug of tea or whatever you like and enjoy this extraordinary conversation I had with Mark Ainley, for which I'm forever grateful.
Dear Mark Ainley, thank you so much for joining us all the way from Vancouver. This is the first time I've had a guest from such a distant location, and I'm thrilled that we can make this happen. But more importantly, I'm excited to have you here with us. I've got plenty of questions lined up, so let's dive in right away.
Fantastic. Thank you for the invitation.
So, Mark, you've become a key figure in preserving and promoting Dino Lipati's legacy. How did you first become interested in researching him, and what drew you to his music and life story?
Well, it was really the life story first that drew me when I started collecting records in my teens, when I became fascinated with historical recordings. So every weekend I would go to the secondhand shops and I would flip through the records. My technique for flipping through records was much better than my piano technique. And so, you know, I was intrigued by... The first time I came across Lipati was, I was doing this all the time, but I came across a record in my high school collection. So my high school had a very small record collection, and I went through, and there was an Angel Records sampler and with lots of different artists. And they said in there, it said, "From Dino Lipati's last recital." Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, this is a very morbid title. I mean, obviously, it just reveals we know this was a pianist who died and his last recital was recorded. And so I was intrigued. And it was a Schubert impromptu that I was learning at the time. So I asked the music teacher at the high school, who wasn't, I don't know how classically trained she was. I mean, we had a high school band. But I asked her, "Who is this Dino Lipati?" And she said, "Oh, he was a pianist's pianist. Everybody loved Lipati." So I said, "Oh, this is interesting." And so I was interested in his life story because of this. Why last recital? What happened? What was the situation? And so when I was doing my weekend shopping, I of course, kept my eyes open for, you know, had a list of names from pianists from Harold Schoenberg's book, The Great Pianists. And I had it, so I added Lipati to my list and I just started buying the records. And my ears weren't so well trained at the time, but I could tell there was something, you know, obviously all the famous musicians who loved Lipati at the time, and they're on the, you know, the notes on the records would say, you know, Francis Poulenc, Clara Haskell, Nadia Boulanger, and all of these great people. So I said, oh, this is interesting. And his sad life story of he died at 33, he was weak, and blah, blah, blah. But what really drew me in more was when I borrowed a record from a friend and I heard his recording of Ravel's Alborada del Grazioso. Because the prevailing story was that Lipati was so sick at his last recital, he couldn't play the last Chopin waltz, he couldn't record much, and so on and so forth. And then I hear this Ravel recording, and it is powerful and it's virtuosic and it's incredible power and volume. And I said, well, wait a second. So he wasn't always weak, he wasn't always sick. Where are some other recordings like this? But he recorded so little officially, but I knew at the time also that there were lots of radio recordings and test recordings and sometimes private recordings of great pianists. I had learned that, you know, these things existed. And so I asked people who knew, and they said, oh no, with Lipati, there's nothing. I said, well, there must be something. So I
But this
decided.
was in Canada, so you were
This
in
was
Canada.
it. So I was in Canada. I was 15 or 16 years old at the time. And I just decided, well, you know, I'll just start writing to European radio stations because they have, you know, as what am I going to do? You just go to the source. And I also contacted people who knew Lipati. I somehow managed, you know, word of mouth before the internet, everything was very different. It was very interesting. So I met someone in Montreal who had had a lesson with Lipati just before he had to stop. But he knew Robert Weiss, who was one of Lipati's pr prime students, who lived in Canada also. So I
Amazing.
contacted him and I spoke to him, and then he put me in touch with Hugues Queneau, who is a singer who Lipati wrote songs for, and so on. And just this chain of connections, one by one. And it seemed very strange for me, I'm just this teenager in Canada, that I could somehow end up in contact with Elisabeth Schwarzkopf and you know, Hugues Queneau and all of these people and several Lipati students.
I bet they were surprised to see.
Well, they were. So when I finally met, Schwarzkopf agreed to an interview, and she in 1990, and then she had to cancel last minute. And in 91, she said she wasn't available. And finally, in 92, a couple of people told her, "No, you should really meet this fellow." And she agreed. And I went to her house, and I show up, and she looks at me, and she says, "How could you possibly know and do what you're doing at your age?" You know, she certainly expected somebody who was not 22 at the time. And so, yeah, I just kind of. You know, there's something to youth and having that power and just sort of nothing can stop me that I had at the time. And so I just followed through on a lot of possibilities.
That's unbreakable.
It was amazing.
So, in the course of your research, you've uncovered rare recordings, photos, and other historic materials. How do you go about finding these treasures, and what have been some of the most significant discoveries? And how does one find the Lipati recording? I mean, we know that there was one recording issued. And then 5, 15 years later was found to be a studio recording by another pianist. So how do you go about
Yeah, so complicated, you know. It's and again at the time all I did was you just write wherever you can. You write to friends, you write to, you know, maybe a friend has a private recording or a student, or you know, writing to EMI. I wrote to them right away and soon discovered that I think EMI could really stand for every mistake imaginable. When I actually got into the archives in 1991 and read the correspondence and found the incredible mistakes that they had made and the missed opportunities. And that included how they released in 1966 a tape, which they, in good faith, they didn't try to lie, they didn't try to hide something. They really thought this was a Lipati recording. And then finally, somebody recognized it on the radio in 1981 when it was reissued. And they said, well, this sounds a lot like this other recording I have. And sure enough, it was. And when I read the correspondence, I really saw they shouldn't have, there was enough doubt that they shouldn't have released it. They didn't deliberately release a wrong recording, but they didn't follow through enough protocols. They actually had an authentic tape of Lipati playing the same concerto, but in worse sound. But if you compare the two, even if pianists play differently on different nights, there's no way it's the same pianist. So that was a huge mistake. However, when it comes to how do you find these recordings? I mean, for me, it was I contact all the European radio stations of in cities where I knew Lipati played. So I wrote to all the Swiss radio stations. I wrote to the German radio stations. And before the internet existed, what I had to do was call the operator, get the phone number for the German consulate, get the phone number for the Swiss consulate. Then I phone up the consulate. I ask them for the address of the news of the radio stations. I go and I type out a letter on an old school typewriter. I write the address on the envelope. I walk to the post office. I mail the letter. I go home and I wait.
Wow.
And nowadays, you could write 10 letters in 10 minutes by copying the letter, cut and paste on a computer by clicking on the website. And so it was very, very different, this analog process of, without digital editing. It was very, very,
I
but
suppose, I mean, I got a reply. This must have been months or years.
sometimes weeks or months. And then in one case, which was devastating, one of the things I was the most excited about was I found in Lipati's biography, they mentioned there's a recording of Bartok's Third Concerto at German radio. And I thought, how is this possible that nobody I know has this? How does the International Piano Archives not have this? How does no collector, who is like a real collector of these private recordings, not have this? So I wrote to the radio station. I get nothing for 3 months, and then a piece of paper arrives in the mail from them with my address. And it's like it's the address label, but the label had no package attached to it. And I thought, what is going on? So I phoned up the radio station. There was the person's name. I phone up the next day. And at this time, it was, a dollar a minute to phone overseas, right? In 1989. And I asked for this woman. I had some basic German. And I asked, if she spoke English. She didn't. She spoke French. So we spoke in French. And I said, oh, so this just arrived. She's like, oh, we sent you the tape.
Oh
And the tape didn't arrive, just the cover of the envelope arrived. Now, they didn't send the original tape. They sent me a cassette, but free of charge. I mean, Swiss radio was charging me, 50 francs an hour. And, these Germans very kindly just sent this tape. So I went in person to Baden-Baden in 1990 to go inside, give me a tape, which of course she didn't charge me for, and to deliver it to EMI.
wow.
So there were things like this that had to happen. You had to visit people. You had to show up in person, but writing was the first step. In terms of the most amazing discovery, it was the fact that some private records showed up in New York when Lipati never left Europe. And what had happened was this man who used to buy estates when somebody died, he was called in and he would buy the collections and he would sell off the parts. And apparently, there was a Romanian doctor living in Geneva. And there were these private records, and they had Lipati's autograph on them. So I went to New York again, what one has to do. And I could see this is Lipati's absolute, his authentic signature. And, but he had no player for the records. Some of the records were already breaking. And he refused to go to an engineer with us to transfer them. He was always delaying, he was always, putting things off. But I went with my friend. Who found out that this man knew a friend of his. So they had a common acquaintance. So as soon as we went downstairs, this is 2008. As soon as we went downstairs, my friend picks, his mobile phone, pre-smartphone days, phones his friend and says, listen, we just met this man. It looks like he has some rare recordings. If you can say nice things, true things about me that, he can trust me and so on, because they've known each other for a long time. Well, nothing worked. And then one day I get an email from this friend of mine. He's like, well, the collector died and we have the records.
Oh my God.
Because the woman went to the record shop of this other man and the man remembered the name and he contacted my friend. And so unfortunately, this man, he didn't get recognition. He didn't get any money for it.
Why do you think he didn't want to?
You know, a lot of people have with Lipati, there's this mystique because it's so rare that it's almost like you have a, lost film of Marilyn Monroe, or you have a Da Vinci sketch or something that nobody has ever seen. And so there becomes this both they want to keep it for themselves, but also they imagine somehow that they're going to get a ton of money, which for Marilyn Monroe or Leonardo da Vinci you might, but in the classical industry or for historical recording, it's not the same kind of thing. So unfortunately, they can just imagine that there's going to be some glory, or they'll end up on the cover of Time magazine. But this is not just realistic, and so just things don't move forward, unfortunately.
So by that time, you said 89, Madeleine Lipati, she was already no longer.
She had already died. Now, this particular case, this was 2008. So I started 1989 was when she had already died, I think in 83. So I was never, I never knew her, never met her. And so, yeah, it was before my time. But unfortunately, she had authenticated, I think, just out of wish, out of hope, that this Chopin tape was Lipati, because they knew a real tape existed. So it's, I think she was just kind of dreaming that that was real. But she also, there were some real things that were found. But other things that, these private recordings, it looks like these ones that showed up in New York, Lipati made before he was recording officially. And they were made for friends on some private equipment. But she should have had copies of those, but maybe.
Wondering how come she as his wife, or even him when he was, in his prime, why he never got these recordings?
This is a bit of a mystery for me still. For example, there was a gentleman in Switzerland who is the one who had the authentic Chopin tape. And when the incident blew up, when the tape was released originally, he contacted her and said, "I have this other tape and this doesn't sound alike." And she got very angry and very upset when he played it for her, because she probably realized the mistake. But when they found the mistake, he offered the real tape to EMI under the condition that there be no legal action taken against Madeleine Lipati. So he did that to protect her. So when she died, he was able to go into the house. He was given permission and to take, there were a lot of materials. And he got to take some boxes of records. And that included the Liszt First Concerto from a broadcast. But there were other boxes, and when he went back, those boxes were gone, and we don't know where they went. But why she had a private recording of Lipati playing Liszt's First Concerto, which I eventually managed to get released with this gentleman, but why she had that, and there's no correspondence to in the EMI archives about that recording, I have no clue. It's an absolute mystery for me. Again, maybe she was holding on to it. Maybe she was worried about the technical quality. I don't know. But it's a mystery how she was so dedicated to preserving his legacy, and yet she also possessed some things.
Can it be maybe that Dino Lipati was not approving to the recording, or?
Possibly, but also the one recording that EMI had in their archives where they had the master, which wasn't released, was the Chopin Barcarolle. And you'll know this recording. It's a very famous one. Lipati did not approve of it, and he didn't allow it to be released, but it was released within 1 year of him dying. So she decided, of course, it was good enough. So she did allow that. But again, it's a mystery. She was obviously suffering from a lot of grief, a lot of emotional turmoil, and she wanted to probably preserve the best. And maybe she was worried about the technical quality of the recording or such. I don't know. So we can only hypothesize. But in any case, it's with Lipati, there's nothing straightforward about finding any of his recordings. Sometimes we struggle just to find minutes, to find, these 15 minutes from New York. There was this like big struggle, and it took years. And same for the Bartok. They tried in the 1960s, and again in the 1970s, and again in the 1980s. And then I show up in the 1990s, and finally I convinced EMI to release it in 2000. And came out a year later in 2001. So some of these things really took an inordinate amount of time. And with some other pianists, there's lots of tapes, and they lived even before him, and there's lots of acetate recordings or radio recordings. But with Lipati, it seems like every second, it seems almost like there's this cosmic conspiracy to limit how much access we have to him. So it's been an interesting struggle.
Yeah, it feels
Definitely.
like there are some golden nuggets in the world, and
This is it. This is it. And it is really gold, it's
yeah. Can you share, I mean, is there any other story behind of one of your most memorable finds related to him? I don't know, a recording, letter, photographs. I mean, I've seen your latest book, and I was so emotional to see all the pictures because they're photographs one has never seen before. So
Yeah.
is which touched you in particular?
Well, certainly these recordings in New York were very important. The Bartok was, I was very pleased that we were able to get that released, even though I don't think he was at his best that night. You can hear that the illness was starting, he was quite weak then. I think one of the most astounding finds is less to do with a recording, but with some documents, which I published for the first time in that Romanian book you're speaking about, where there were other contributors to, amazing photographs and documents and so on. Orlando Murin did an incredible job of accessing some phenomenal photographs of Libati that show us another side of him. And it was when in 1991, again, just because of who I knew, I met the recording producer Brian Crimp, who had started the APR label. And he used to work for EMI. And in fact, when in 1971, for the first time, EMI was going to release this Chopin recording, his job was to stand with a stopwatch and play the record and put the timing. So just like now, you would put it into the computer and you have the timing. He had to, that was his part of his job. And he heard this performance and he went to his producer and he said, "There's no way this is Dinu Lipati." So actually, his musical ears could tell him also. And 10 years later, we found he was right. In any case, he did research at EMI's archives. And one of my visits to Europe, he arranged for me to go with him to the documents archive, where they also kept all the recording matrices and all of the original materials. And they, because he knew the main archivist, they put me in a room with Lipati's folder. And it was just left there with my back. I mean, I could have put documents in my bag. I mean, I was completely unsupervised, and I'm 21 years old, there in a t-shirt and jeans, going through this document, these documents. And I pick up this memo that was signed by Walter Legg, who is Lipati's recording producer, who wrote very eloquently and movingly about Lipati. And one of the things he said was that, they recorded so little because Lipati was such a perfectionist. And that he required 3 years to prepare the Tchaikovsky concerto and 4 years to prepare Beethoven's Emperor. But we didn't have that time, he said. Well, then I'm holding this document that's dated in 1948 that says Dinu Lipati has agreed to record the Tchaikovsky concerto next year with Karajan. That should be a bestseller for 10 years. And my everything just like my whole my brain just seemed to explode. I was like, how is this possible? This is his signature. He's the same one who 3 years later was claiming that Lipati refused to record the work. And that Lipati, it says Lipati was willing to do this on 1 year's notice. And then there's another memo that the same producer had written that says Lipati has his heart set on recording a Beethoven concerto. Let's do the Emperor. And then all this correspondence, I was like, what is going on here? This is like the whole thing is a myth. What are the lies and why? And I can only guess that he might have had a bad memory, but he also might have only realized when it was too late that he didn't take advantage of every opportunity and that he tried to minimize the fact that by the time Lipati died, there were only 3 hours of recordings with EMI. And that he might have done more. He might have made some more effort. And there was more. There were other documents where other people were suggesting, let's record Lipati in Switzerland. And he says, oh, no, there's no need to do that. So he missed really some opportunity. So I was reading this correspondence and then about the Chopin concerto. And I read this letter that says, we have, in fact, an inferior tape of Lipati playing this concerto in Zurich, and it's not the same. I thought, oh, my gosh, they had another tape and they put out this. Let's put out the tape that's good. In other words, with better sound quality. And I thought, my goodness. So really my whole, I realized the whole biography we'd been told, there was a lot of inaccuracy and a lot of misrepresentation about Lipati's intentions and about his playing, about his repertoire, and about his willingness to record. So that was probably, in addition to the recordings, I think that realization that the story about his recordings and his small discography, that it was not accurate, that was the biggest discovery for me.
Well, that must have been quite a sad moment because it's not adding up, and what a loss.
Yeah, and that's what you realize. And of course, hindsight is 20/20. We can all look back and say, and Dipati, I think, possibly looked back and, might have looked back and said, oh, I could have done this or I could have done that. But in fact, there were a few cases where it seemed like Lipati was trying to push in his gentle way. He probably had this very gentle, more cultivated demeanor where he doesn't want to be pushy. And he's suggesting, oh, what if we did this and what if we did that? And, and the producer, he was managed. I mean, to give him some credit, he was managing how many artists? He was responsible for so many artists. And he probably just didn't think as clearly that, oh, we should do this right away. So, it's understandable that some mistakes would have been made, but it was, of course, it was quite devastating to see. Lipati said, oh, it said Lipati has his heart also on set on recording the Étude Symphonique of Schumann. And the day of that memo is when he recorded Alborada. So it was when he was in good form. I mean, what? Just put him in the studio the same day. This is what we would do. Just put him in front of the piano, turn the machine on, and just, let it keep going. So some missed opportunities, unfortunately.
Dino Lipati's early years are often noted for his prodigious talent. Could you share more about his formative years and the influences that shaped his unique artistry?
Well, he was clearly, drawn to the piano, although he started with a violin as well. And there's a famous photo of him with his godfather, George Enescu, which is very moving. There were several pianists who played violin before piano, and they all had beautiful sound, which is very interesting. Clara Haskell as well, apparently. I believe it was Busoni, Egon Petri. So there were a number of them. Harold Bauer only picked up piano in his late teens or his 20s. He was playing violin until then. So it's quite amazing to think of that. So he was certainly in a musical environment with, someone like Enescu around him. But it was probably Florica Muzicescu who had the most impact. She also taught Radu Lupu and the other great Romanian pianist, one of whose students I studied with in Montreal also. Who died on stage very sadly, Mindru Katz. So
Oh, incredible that you're mentioning him because I've had a student today who was telling me that she spoke with somebody from Canada, and she was talking about my podcast, and he told her, "Tell Alexandra, I've had lessons with Mândru Katz."
he's probably my former teacher as well. Yaron Ross.
I'll let you
Let
stay.
me know. Yeah. So it was amazing that, I mean, as well, to have that kind of connection. And you hear something similar in all of these artists, incredibly polished sound and really clarity of voicing and so on. I think it was from her that he really picked up his perfectionist attitude. He might have had that as well, but she certainly instilled that in him as well. And then, of course, he had some amazing later influences, when he went to study with Cortot, who said he had nothing to teach him. But I think in his early years, I think, he also studied with Mihail, I don't know how to pronounce it, Jora.
Jean,
But I think Muzicescu was probably the most significant influence and really instilled in him this dedication and attitude towards absolute perfection and clarity.
How do you think Clara Haskell has influenced him or his or their friendship?
It was adorable because they had such a clear friendship. He called her Clarinette, and they were really almost like brother and sister. They were so very, very close. And again, something that makes one dream is the fact that they played in Paris the Mozart concerto for two pianos together, and just the thought of something like that existing is mind-blowing. But I think it was more that they admired each other tremendously. And I think this is one of the great things when we have great artists who appreciate other great artists' music making, and that sort of honesty and modesty and appreciation of someone else. So I think it was more that in terms of an influence, I'm not sure in terms of style, he certainly adored her Mozart, and who doesn't? I mean, she was just one of the most incredible Mozart players, but of course we know that Lipati was as well. So I think it was more the camaraderie and that kinship that they felt, both being Romanian, both being elsewhere, certainly after the war, and although they knew each other in Paris as well before the war.
Yeah, true. Many describe Lipati's playing as having an unparalleled refinement and clarity. In your view, what made his interpretation so distinct, particularly in the works of composers like Bach and Chopin?
There is something about Lipati's playing that is so distinctive that you can usually recognize it within a few moments. And in fact, in one occasion, I had one of these private recordings from New York. I had a music professor who came over, and before they were released, I said, "I want you to listen to something." And I put it on, and within 3 seconds, she said, "But this is Lipati. But he didn't record these pieces. Where did you get this?" So it's that his touch was that distinctive. And there's a number of qualities, just like there's a number of components that will make any performance or interpretation or interpreter, who they are and what separates one from the other. The quality of sound, there was never a harsh sound, always a beautiful tone. And in older recordings, it can be harder to hear this at times. But when we listen carefully and we know how to listen beyond any of the restrictions in the acoustic, we can hear the beauty of sound. With Lipati in particular, there's an ironclad rhythm where the precision of rhythm is so much that you could almost set a metronome to it, except that he would still, of course, make very gentle adjustments to tempo so that it wasn't boxy. There was always some breathing room. There's the shape of the phrasing where the inflection of, to clarify for those, I think sometimes phrasing is really not well phrased or articulated for many people, that in the same way that a sentence, my sentence, will go up and then it goes down in a way that's natural, it sounds natural. His musical phrases, the melody that you would sing, has a natural rise and fall where there's a fluidity, there's a naturalness. The no note is too loud, out of sequence. There's a natural flow. And so this is accomplished by his fingers, by the fact that he could play so smoothly and then just use enough pedal to provide some nuance or some atmosphere without making it cloudy. His producer said that he said Lipati was the cleanest pianist that he'd ever worked with. And that's one of those qualities. But I think what we hear, especially in Bach, who he said was the composer closest to his heart, was a level of transparency, where it doesn't sound like it's one piano playing, because he could so clearly highlight with Bach all the different melodies and all the different voices that it sounds like chamber music, and it sounds like each voice is a different instrument. And this is a level of technique where, of course, his Alborada Grazioso, I mean, this is incredible technique, and we hear this virtuosity and this volcanic temperament. And nowadays, with pianists, we hear, lots of people can play Petrushka, when back in Lipati's day, actually, it was very rare for somebody to play that. It was beyond the normal capability of what pianists could be expected to do. And yet you hear Lipati play something like Bach, which some people might dare to say is quote unquote easy. And you hear him do things that's just so impossible to imagine. And when you can really hear this, I think even amateurs are able to recognize there's something different. And then the professionals will listen and say, "My gosh, how did he highlight this voice in that way? And how does he highlight this voice in the right hand? And then it's repeated in the left hand. And the volume is such that you hear it's as if it's the same voice continuing in a different register, or it sounds like a different instrument. Edwin Fischer, who was a great admirer of Lipati's, when he was teaching, he would often tell his pupils, like, oh, your cellos aren't loud enough. You know, that they need to bring out that register and the hand that was playing that voice. And with Lipati, it really sounds symphonic somehow, that there's this incredible dimensionality to his play. And I think his Bach brings it out even more than his Chopin. His Chopin has the clarity. What's amazing is that there's the pedal is used but not overused. So it's not like this atmospheric haze, which he could appreciate when well done in others, in Alfred Cortot, for example, whose playing he loved. But with Lipati, it was so clear but still atmospheric. And then the tempo adjustments would be there, but they would be so logically coordinated that there's the combination of feeling and intellect that I think is so distinctive.
Amazing. Dino Lipati was known for his relatively small recorded output, but a length compared to small in output, but of the purest gold. Think makes his limited discography so enduring and influential in the classical music world?
I think we have to look at, what drew me to Lipati first was the biography, and it was the mystique. So there's no question that the fact that he recorded so little attracts a lot of attention. However, when he was alive, his playing still attracted a lot of attention. And there's no doubt if he'd recorded much more and died young, he still would have, we would still be revering his recordings. And of course, if he had lived longer, there's no, I think he would have been seen as really far greater. His influence would have been tremendous. Because he was his the timing of his recordings is just on the cusp. After the Second World War, there was a change in aesthetic where a lot of the 19th century born and trained pianists were starting to die, right? They were getting older and dying. So we had only, two or three pupils of Liszt who were alive at the time. Cortot was in his last years. So the pianists who played with a much more personal style. There was starting to be a movement away from this and having a more objective approach, a more neutral approach. Now, the irony is that Lipati might have had this neutral approach, and yet he's so distinctive that, as I said, we can listen to a few notes and we can tell, well, this is Lipati. So there's this ironic combination of neutrality and personality and persona that's there simultaneously. I think it's because he had this tremendous technical command and clarity and his intention that there's some kind of depth and focus again in his playing that even an amateur can recognize that. And I'll tell a little story about this. When the first CDs of his recordings were coming out in the late 1980s, I had a part-time job at a record store in Montreal where I grew up. And the first CDs arrived, and there was the one with his famous Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring and so on. So I put the CD on. Every single person in the shop came up to see what was playing. We had seven copies of the CD, and they all sold out before the piece was finished. And we had to place special orders to order more because people said, I want to get that. Oh, we just sold out. Well, I want to get that. Please order it. And the CDs were very expensive at the time, but everybody could hear there's something unique going on. Now, for all of us, we can look at some great art or architecture and so on. We might look at something, if we're not trained, we might look or hear something that's not perfect and we might still appreciate it. But when there's something that's really great, I think everybody can usually recognize that. And that somehow seems to be the fact with Lipati. There's this magnetism and intensity and focus to his playing that's so magnetic that I think it just seems to appeal to everyone.
Yeah, that's true. Considering his tragically short career, how do you think his recordings have continued to shape modern interpretations of classical?
I think again, the mystique and the legend and the fact that, most professional pianists appreciate Lipati's playing. And so they tend to tell people, if they're learning the Chopin waltzes, well, go listen to Lipati. If you're learning from Bach, go listen to Lipati. you're learning the Grieg concerto, go listen to Lipati. So I think there's that level. I think the fact that he was heading towards, he was again on the cusp of this change in aesthetic where there things were more text-based, even though Lipati did make changes to the text, and this is something that's often not looked at, but his playing sounds so by the book and clean and still so musically intelligent that I think a lot of teachers have suggested his playing to their students. I think the mystique, I think the fact that the record companies have continued to reissue his recordings, and the fact that magazines will always say if they're, reviewing the Chopin waltzes, it's always Lipati's that comes out first in terms of a historical one, and then there might be a more modern one that they suggest also. So I think his influence has been significant because every generation since he died, and it's 1950, which means now it's a little shocking to me because I remember the 40th anniversary of his death, and we're now past the 70th anniversary. So I'm feeling my age a little bit. But the fact that every generation, people in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, everybody, pianists of those generations have all appreciated his artistry, which I consider to be remarkable. Other great musicians, Cortot, there'll be people who love him or people who don't love him. There'll be, Hoffman is very divisive, Friedman, a lot of great pianists who were more personal in their expression, more spontaneous. Some of them have been sometimes out of favor, sometimes more appreciated. But with Lipati, it seems to be absolutely consistent. And I think it's the fact that his clarity and devotion to the text, but not just to the text, I think he's devoted to the heart of the music. And I think there's something there that just really comes through.
Incredible quality.
Indeed.
There's often a sense of perfection associated with Lipati's playing. Do you think this idea of perfection, because you also mentioned it before,
No.
play a role in how he approached recording sessions and perhaps in the recordings that exist today? And do you think he had a different approach when recording than in concert?
Yeah, this is very important, in fact, because all artists are different in the studio. I think because he was a perfectionist, actually, the recording process really did appeal to him. And he could have been before Glenn Gould, he could have been a similar kind of artist. He apparently joked with Walter Legg, his producer, saying, "Let us devote our lives to making records." And I suspect that, again, this was his gentle hint at saying, "Why aren't we recording more? Let's do some more." But I think that he had this concept of perfection, and he appreciated, we know from an interview, he appreciated being able to redo things until they were to his satisfaction. So there is that. As much as I'm a specialist in historical recordings, and of course, I love recordings, I mean, how else could we listen to these people who died before we were born? I still think recording technology has had a negative impact on spontaneity in concerts because people are so afraid of mistakes.
Yeah, today now even more.
Today,
I mean, the boom.
absolutely, more and more, and with competitions and so on. And I think that in a sense, Lipati was part of, he was at the forefront of this whole concept of perfectionism in recording. And he also aimed for that in concert. But we do know that at times he would indeed play differently in different circumstances. So these home recordings that we found eventually in, Brooklyn, New York, that were recorded, not intended to be released, they were just shared with friends, but we hear incredible passion and drive here and a lot of freedom. Now, he might have played that way in the recording studio more often if he were not so sick, possibly. But in the Schumann Concerto, for example, he recorded with Karajan. There he had to submit somewhat to Karajan's authority, and Karajan was playing faster than he wanted. And when we hear him 2 years later in concert, he was playing much more spaciously and lyrically. He apparently was leaving the studio one day after the first day of the Karajan recording and said in a stage whisper, probably hoping that Karajan would hear it, saying, "Oh, well, we should let him play the piano and I can conduct if he wants it at that speed." He actually had, and this is something that's interesting, he had a sharper sense of humor than people imagine. So that's quite fascinating.
Can
But
you?
I think he did have a different approach. I think a lot of artists, you know, we know that there's a lot of artists who hated the recordings. Myra Hess, beautiful recordings. She hated the process. She loved, and we can hear in concert recordings as well that she indeed played with more passion and more vitality. Lipati, you know, so we hear this kind of pristine quality. And I think, especially in his last recordings, I think he knew he was dying. He knew this was his legacy. He wanted it to be perfect. And if I may, I actually don't consider them his best recordings for that reason, because there is a little bit too much perfection, even. Because when we listen to some of the other ones, I think we can hear a little bit more. Of course, they're still absolutely magnificent. I wouldn't want to live without them. But I think it does point towards that more modern aesthetic of let's have one perfect interpretation. But I also believe that, you know, we might have one perfect interpretation one time, and then a year later we've revisited our concept, or that it might be different on a certain occasion, and so on. So
But
it's a challenging paradox.
this leads me to the next question, which would, what role do you think did Lipati's health struggles play in his emotional and musical output, especially in his later performances?
Yeah, I think we can hear certainly, for example, in his first recording session in London, February 20, 1947, he recorded Chopin's D flat Nocturne, Opus 27, number 2. That is gorgeous. It's a magnificent recording. And then 3 years later in Zurich, same month, February 7, 1950, we hear him playing it in concert without time limit. And of course, after 3 years of where his health had severely declined, and it's a much more spacious, deep performance. They're both magnificent, and they're both distinctively Lipati. You can recognize his playing, even though they're different. So I absolutely think that there was a change in his playing. In his final recordings, he in fact wasn't so weak. And this is almost, again, a bit of a paradox and a bit of an unfortunate choice in terms of what was selected, because his energy was boosted by the cortisone injections he was receiving. And so he had a lot of strength. But what they recorded was what he played at his last recital a few months later, which in 1949, he had devised this program, which he called his less tiring program. The Bach First Partita, Mozart Eighth Sonata, two Schubert Impromptus, 14 Chopin waltzes. But when he had more vitality with the cortisone, he could have recorded pieces that required more vitality, like Beethoven Waldstein Sonata, Schumann Etudes Symphoniques. And in fact, they planned to record those October of 1950, when these recordings were done in July, but by that time his health had deteriorated too much. So I think it was a missed chance that we hear him with more strength, but he's playing his weaker, quote unquote, program. But I think he was in a very upbeat mood when he was doing these. So we hear, in a sense, there's the perfectionism, but there's also the optimism, but it's tinged with a little bit of sadness. I think we can hear a blend of these different emotions when we listen to those final recordings. But, and in concert, of course, those final recordings, we hear the Bartok. We can hear, you know, after that concert, he didn't play another concert for 6 months or a year or 18 months. There was quite a long period after that concert. And we can hear that there's almost like an energetic weight in his play. And in the, of course, in the last recital, we can hear that he was struggling quite a bit. But so there's a lot of emotion that's there that we can hear, I think, when we listen carefully.
If Lipari had lived longer, how do you think his career and interpretations might have evolved? And which composers or works do you think he would have further explored?
Yeah, that is a fascinating question. I think his influence would have been enormous, because he again was balancing. He was pointing towards some of the issues. You know, he could be very free and not with the text in his performances. The fact that we have him playing the Bach Busoni Concerto in Amsterdam in 47, which is absolutely not Urtext style music.
Thanks.
That changes our perception of Lipati quite a bit. And yet, what he wrote about interpretation was very also modern, about following the score, but also looking towards the future and saying that any music that's being played after the era in which it was written should never be bound by the rules and regulations of that time. So we should not be held back by Baroque practices if we're playing Bach 3 centuries later. Very intelligent, very interesting. And he was also looking at how each composer was almost predicting what was coming next. And so I think that there would have been, I'm not so convinced that the original instruments and the Urtext emphasis that we have now would have necessarily had the same impact if someone like Lipati were around to somewhat challenge this, who provided such articulate perspectives and also interpretations that were respectful of the text, but also individual. So I think he could have had an enormous impact on the music making of the 20th century and beyond if he had been around longer. We know he was due in 1951 to teach a multiple day symposium with Nadia Boulanger, and that's where some of these notes come from, where he was talking about, not being held back by the performances at the time. And he said sometimes, if you just look back, it's like dressing up an adult in adolescent clothing. And so when you think of somebody with Lipati's authority and intelligence and respect saying something like this, I'm very interested in what kind of conversations and debates might have happened amongst those who would come in the decades afterwards, espousing original instruments and espousing strict adherence to the text without any variation and so on. I think it could have been very, very interesting. And of course, it's a huge loss. In terms of repertoire, what we might have heard, we certainly would have heard Beethoven and much more of it. And again, this is, some of the myths that were propagated by Walter Legg, his producer, and also his widow. He had already played Beethoven's Emperor Concerto in 1941 in Bucharest. I spoke with someone who was there, and it was magnificent. And the next day, she went for her lesson with Florica Muzicescu, and she went up the stairs, and Lipati was there playing one note after another, just repeating one note to get the right sound. After
Where
he, that was
was that
in Bucharest.
radio
It was in
or
Bucharest. It was in concert. It might have been broadcast. It might exist somewhere. This would be one of the most incredible discoveries ever if that were to show up. It's not impossible. And in 1948, he broadcast on the BBC Beethoven's Waldstein, and apparently he wrote that the piano was wonderful, the technicians were wonderful, and this again was around. It was the same within the same few days that he recorded Alborada and the Chopin Barcarolle. He was in fantastic form. So this would be the most amazing discovery. And the story is that the BBC erased the tape. Now, whether somebody copied it, and again, it's in the family archive and being held like a lost Da Vinci or Marilyn Monroe or something like this is what one wonders. But there have been pervasive rumors. And that's my dream, is that that should show up. But of course, he would have played many more composers. He had Debussy programmed. He had the Chopin Etudes. He had an incredible recital where he would play Bach Preludes and Fugues alternating with Chopin Etudes, I think it was. And then he had Beethoven's Hammer Clavier. That's what he was really hoping to live for and to record the next year. So I think we would have heard him in a huge range of repertoire. And he already played pieces that we don't expect. Most people don't recognize that, he played Ravel's Tombeau de Couperin. He had this incredible recital. If we could find one recital recording. And this is where my regret is, what we have of him play, in his last recital, and he was weak and the sound isn't good. But a couple of years earlier in Paris, he played four Preludes and Fugues, the Waldstein, the Étude Symphonique, and Tombeau de Couperin. I mean, this is so astounding on just in terms of a recital program. Think of Lipati's way with each of these composers and how that could have been. Had he lived, we would have had him, of course, recording this repertoire and playing this and beyond. So it's almost unimaginable what we could have had from him artistically.
Mark, finally, I suppose your biggest dream would be to find more and more recordings. At least another two works by Ravel and Beethoven, the one you've already mentioned. but would you like to share with us which ones they are and what would be actually the most beautiful? What would be your dream to discover, to find?
Well, what actually started all of my research was hearing about the Waldstein. And yet, it wasn't the BBC version. This is again where there's these mysteries that show up, and there's still, how many years later? I don't want to count, but 35 plus years later, I was reading a book, an essay that was written by Lipati's widow in a tribute book, and she said that soon after they arrived in Switzerland, Lipati, gave a broadcast in the studio, and he played the Enescu Third Sonata and the Beethoven Waldstein. And I said, wait, hold on. The Enescu Sonata recording exists. In the same session, he played the Waldstein. What's going on here? And that was actually my first letter overseas, was writing to that Swiss radio station where they said it was recorded on wire. They didn't have the original recording still. And it was rebroadcast in 1949. And Lipati wrote a letter about, I found out many years later, Lipati wrote a letter that it was rebroadcast. And that's possibly when he got a copy. We actually now have, my colleague in Germany now has Madeleine's copies of the discs of this, but no Waldstein. But whether somebody else recorded the Waldstein, whether it was broadcast another time, I have no idea. For me, the Beethoven Waldstein would be revelatory because of Lipati's sense of rhythm, his transparency, his voicing, and the vitality that he had at the time, both in 1943 and also in 1948 for the BBC. BBC would be ideal. And then the other is Ravel's G major concerto, which, again, absolute mystery. There's always a mystery with Lipati. We have a 1947 broadcast recording of Lipati playing the Bach Busoni concerto, which I mentioned. At the same concert, he played the Ravel G major concerto. First of
Incredible.
all, incredible to have Bach and Ravel played on the same program by the same pianist. But then, where is that recording? And how is it that we have one and not the other? This is an absolute mystery. The archives don't have it. It's possible that only one of them was broadcast on the radio, and therefore a transcription disc survived and not the other. It's for me, it's still an absolute mystery. But to imagine Lipati playing the Ravel G major when we have his Alborada, when we again tend to think of him as kind of strict when we hear his Bach in the studio, but then you hear his Bach Busoni, and it's quite unconventional. To imagine him on the same night in good health, playing the Ravel G major concerto, this I think would be a revelation. So those are the two where there's, in a sense, a high possibility that a recording should exist. This would
That was supposed to be my last question, but I can't stop. It's like, are you waiting every day, like a magical thing to happen, or how?
I know I don't consciously think about it. I mean, certainly back in the 80s and 90s when I was really quite focused on this every day, I was, of course, waiting for an envelope to come through the mailbox, so it was very different back then because of the analog world. I'm certainly more aware that if we're discovering now, we're discovering recordings from the 1920s and even before, cylinder recordings from the 1890s that are being discovered for the first time. We are living at the most unparalleled time of these of historical recordings being discovered that were previously lost, and also of radio recordings. These things are coming out that there are radio recordings from the 30s and 40s that are being found now. I absolutely do imagine that there is the possibility one day I'll get a message that, hey, Hey, guess what just got found? Somebody just dug through, French radio archives, and they found that that Bach, Beethoven, Schumann, Ravel concert. I mean, I don't think about it every day, but certainly I always hope that I'm going to get a message like this, and we can all hope. So let's cross our fingers and toes that we have some good luck and some more of Lipati will be discovered.
Do you think there are any, were there any family members left? Or, after Madeleine died, was there anybody else, somebody who could? I'm also surprised that it's only you who's keeping the torch of.
Well, there's a few actually. So, I mean, again, I must give credit to Orlando Murin, who he befriended the daughter of Lipati's doctor, Dr. Dubois Ferrière, who was present at the last recital. So she was friends with Madeleine, and she was the one who then had some of the collection. And we know that Dr. Gertsch had some of the collection in Switzerland, Fan, and then she got some of the collection. She passed away, sadly, quite recently. But fortunately, Mr. Morin was able to ensure that her family preserved everything. And so there will be, they are safely protected and going into archives. So this is fantastic news. But in terms of other family, I think it was only cousins. And so there is another relative, quite aged, in Switzerland, with whom Mr. Morin has been in contact. And so they've also preserved, and he's been able to preserve a number of photographs and documents. So it is, there is something, but there, some of these people also didn't have, they didn't keep things. There was some complicated family relationships with people remarrying and so on. So there was some very obscure relative actually living in, when he was last in Vienna, he was there. He was a child when Lipati died, but he was tied in on Madeleine's side of the family somehow. But he also didn't have anything.
Do you
So.
think if Dino Lipati had any pupils, or was he?
I contacted everybody I could. Yeah,
No.
I missed a few. Unfortunately, because of some of the people I spoke with weren't talking with the other ones, or they weren't in contact, and so and again, before the internet, I didn't, I couldn't, it was a lot harder to reach out to everyone. So now, unfortunately, some folks have passed away. I again, one of the most amazing things, there was a pupil of Lipati's who I had never heard of, and his daughter wrote to me, and he was still alive, and I think it was during COVID. We had a Skype call, with this elderly man, and all he had a painting that was done of Lipati at the piano that somebody had given him. But no recordings, no other documents, and some people had letters. There was a gentleman who wrote to me very kindly, whose father had been an admirer of Lipati's, and he had some letters that Lipati had sent him, and he just offered them to me. And he sent me all the newspaper clippings and the letters, and it was very touching. So we never know what might show up. Somebody from somebody's family or whatever who might have recorded something off the radio, might have had some correspondence, might have had some photos. Again, that was extremely, this was beyond unexpected that he would write to me, and then I get this package in the mail of.
That must have been something.
It was wonderful, and some of them are business cards where Lipati wrote him a little note, or it was very beautiful and very touching. So,
But who are all There is somebody in the world who would like to write Mark Ainley and let him know there is still some material by Dino Lipati. I will put your website in the description,
thank
and
you.
the entire world would be fortunate to have any.
We would be, and I have to say that also, because my name has been more published in terms of this research, and I've done a lot of work, but it all was the collaborative work of so many people. That Brian Crimp at APR, I would not have, without him, I would not have gone into the EMI archives. Without my colleague Werner Unger in Germany, that we were able to really negotiate well with Dr. Gertsch in Bern to be able to release some of these private recordings from Madeleine's collection. Orlando Morin doing his work, and Monica Izacescu in Romania, doing incredible work and making sure that this wonderful book got published in Romania. So it's been so many people who've had a role to play. And again, these people from the public. who, would just say, write something, or I heard this. And I've had many such things, and people sending me concert programs because they were in an archive and they found something, so they took a copy for me. It's been wonderful. So Lipati is kind of a sort of a musical and spiritual glue, or a sort of material that binds many people together with this fascination of, this concept of perfection and spiritually aligned interpretation and so on. So I can just hope that this will continue and more people will be able to indeed, perhaps something will be found.
Well, I certainly I'm really quite emotional and touched to have spoken to you today, because it's like if he was really with us for 1 hour.
Right. I agree.
As a pianist, for me he's more than anybody else. Dino Lipati, Clara Haskell, and Radu Lupu are the three gods. And thank you so much for your time, for your conversation, for your expertise, and for your research. And I wish you all the best, and that this continues for all of us.
Thank you so much, and thank you for inviting me to be on your program and to share with your audience more about this amazing pianist.
Thank you all so much for tuning in to this special episode of the Pianofortissimo podcast. It's been an honor to celebrate Dino Lipati's extraordinary legacy with you, and I hope you found our conversation with Mark Ainley as inspiring as I have. A big thank you to everyone who has subscribed, shared, and supported the podcast. Your messages and feedback mean the world to me. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram, on Alexandra Siloccia, or the Piano Fortissimo podcast account to keep the conversation going. And be sure to join us for our next episode. And until next time, worry less and let the music flow. Thanks for listening. This was Alexandra Siloccia from Piano Fortissimo. Don't forget to subscribe, share with fellow music enthusiasts, follow us on your favorite social media, and most importantly, worry less and let the music flow.